step.
Good evening. Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the Fort Lauderdale Primary Purpose Big Book Study Group Thursday Night Alcoholics and God Speaker Step Series. I've asked Kat to come up and tell us a joke.
Kat, alcoholic.
Hey, Kat.
Okay, I know Halloween was yesterday, but this is just a Halloween joke. Why couldn't the ghost go to the AA meeting? No booze allowed.
Thank you. I'm a recovered alcoholic. My name is Fred. Thank you for joining us tonight. In a minute, we're going to start our two-minute meditation, so please take a moment to get situated. Please turn off all devices that make noise or will distract others. Just take this time to get connected to God. Let the craziness of the day drift away and ask God to help you stay focused on the study tonight. Is everybody ready? Let's start the meditation. Join me in the fog light prayer. If you don't know it, it's on the banner up there. God, let your love shine through me like a fog light, so those who are lost, sick, and dying can find your love through me. There is a solution from the Big Book, page 17. The tremendous fact for every one of us is that we have discovered a common solution. We have a way out on which we can absolutely agree and upon which we can join in brotherly and harmonious action. This is the great news this book carries to those who suffer from alcoholism. I've asked Victor to come up and read Appendix 2, Spiritual Experience. We read this because the main purpose of the 12 steps is to have one, so it's kind of important to know when one is.
Victor, alcoholic. Amen. Spiritual Experience. The term spiritual experience and spiritual awakening are used many times in this book, which upon careful reading shows that the personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism has manifested itself among us in many different forms. Yet it is true that our first printing gave many readers the impression that these personality changes or religious experiences must be in the nature of sudden and spectacular upheavals. Happily for everyone, this conclusion is erroneous. In the first few chapters, a number of sudden revolutionary changes are described. Though it was not our intention to create such an impression, many alcoholics have nevertheless concluded that in order to recover, they must acquire an immediate and overwhelming God consciousness, followed at once by a vast change in feeling and outlook. Among our rapidly growing membership of thousands of alcoholics, such transformations, though frequent, are by no means the rule. Most of our experience are what the psychologist William James calls the educational variety, because they develop slowly over a period of time. Quite often, friends of a newcomer are aware of the difference long before he is himself. He finally realizes that he has undergone a profound alteration of his reaction to life, and that such a change could hardly have been brought about himself alone. What often takes place in a few months could seldom be accomplished by years of self-discipline. With a few exceptions, our members find that they have tapped an unsuspected inner resource that they presently identify with their own conception of a power greater than themselves. Most of us think this awareness of a power greater than themselves is an essence of a spiritual experience. Our more religious members call it God consciousness. Most emphatically, we wish to say that any alcoholic capable of honestly facing his problems in the light of our experience can recover, provided he does not close his mind to all spiritual concepts. He can only be defeated by an attitude of intolerance or belligerent denial. We find that no one need have difficulty with the spirituality of the program. Willingness, honesty, and open-mindedness are essentials of recovery, but these are indispensable. There is a principle which is a bar against all information, which is proof against all arguments, and which cannot fail to keep a man in everlasting ignorance. That principle is contempt prior to investigation. Herbert Spencer.
Please refrain from disturbing others by talking or constantly getting up and sitting back down. This is a tech-free meeting, so please set your phones to airplane or meeting mode, or just simply turn them off. So now I get to introduce Pat, and I'm excited to hear Pat. He always makes me laugh, and we get to hear his experience, strength, and hope. Welcome, Pat.
That's cool that you can do this. This is not a tech-free meeting. This is like, I'm a recovered alcoholic. My name is Pat Rogan. Thanks to the 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous outlined in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is a program of AA, I have recovered from a seemingly hopeless mind. Another joint, turn the radio loud. I'm too alone to be proud. And you don't know how it feels. You don't know how I feel. You don't know how I feel. To be me. Great song, right? But Tom had the same solution. Right? One of us. Song goes on to say, so let's get to the point. Let's roll another joint. Because you don't know how I feel, you know. And we're talking about the fourth step. That's exactly where I'm at, man. That's me, man. You don't know how I feel, you know. And if you felt like me, you'd medicate. That's just the deal, you know. And that's always been my deal. It's always been my life. I hated the way I felt, and I was this song. I heard this song today. I'm a big Tom Petty fan. I love Tom, and we know now that he was one of us. That he went out like a lot of people are going out today. And if you're out there playing games, that's the deal right there. I mean, they're trying to kill you. They're trying to kill you out there, and you're just, you know, one hit, one shot, one bag, you know. And we don't even know where all this fentanyl is now. I mean, it's just. It's just killing right now. I mean, we're losing people, you know, a few people a week that I know of, and I know countrywide it's epidemic proportions, and it's just sad, you know, and how many great artists we've seen go down that road. But, I mean, forget. I mean, that's just because they're publicized. I mean, you know, I can tell you I know three people this week that have overdosed. And it's just, and Tom went down that road, but I always loved Tom because, he, you know, and I love artists like him who come from the heart. That's my kind of groove right there. I mean, that's, I was talking to these guys before the meeting, and I said, you know, after my divorce, I went out there and started doing a little bit of dating right away, and I realized that after two marriages and a couple failed relationships, it's not them. You know what I mean? Like, somewhere you wake up and go, I don't get along with anybody. Oh, it ain't them. And so I dated the devil and some of his cohorts there for a while. And and I realized that, you know, I'm dating this girl, and, you know, I'm playing my music that I love, and we're going out for a little while, and she looks at me one day and goes, "Everything you listen to is dark." And I went, "Yeah, I never looked at it that way, you know." And so I went home, and I started looking through all my CDs, and I said, "Damn, you know." And that, but that's my groove. That's where I connect. You know, I connect with the dark, bluesy, grooving type rock and roll. You know, and that's just, and it's true though. I'm a lyrics guy when it comes to listening to music. I do like some stuff that, but usually I'm into that lyrics. And Tom always touched my heart, and I really never realized that he was really struggling like he did. And But I had that song stuck in my head all day long, so I came here and I said, "Mike, you got to play this song for me, because it's where we're at. It's you know, the conversation has gone, you know, and I touched on this last week, but the conversation started physical and mental, and then in step three it went behavioral. You know, they like, look, is, you know, it's our behavior that's the issue. That what's killing you is you're selfish, you're self-centered, driven by 100 forms of fear, self-pity, self-delusion. You step on everybody's toes around you. You put yourself in conflict with everybody around you, and they retaliate, and you blame them. I mean, he doesn't say that, but that's what we do. We blame them. But in the fourth step, immediately he talked about a spiritual sickness. He talked about a spiritual malady. That unless we overcome this spiritual malady, this spiritual illness, this spiritual disease, unless we overcome this spiritual malady, we will never recover physically and mentally. That we'll never be able to stay stopped is the way I get that, unless I overcome this internal condition. So it went from mental and physical to behavioral to emotional. That there's an emotional issue going on here that we're treating. And yeah, I mean, and that conflict is not helping the emotional issue. But the truth is, with me, and I don't know about you guys, that I've been dealing with an emotional issue since as far back as I can remember. You know, I was a five-year-old dealing with emotional issues. You know, I'm skipping school in third grade. Who does that? You know, like, why does an eight-year-old have to skip school? I was probably seven in third grade. I think my mom needed me to go to school quick, so I was in school at five. You know, they had different cutoffs back in those days. So, and that being said, I'm younger than everybody. I'm smaller than everybody. I'm a little behind everybody. So it wasn't a good idea. But, you know, look, my mom was trying to raise four kids on her own, and she needed a babysitter. And that's kind of how that happens, you know. And so, I mean, I'm dealing with emotional issues in third grade. I'm skipping school. I'm getting caught skipping school in third grade. I don't even know why. And I had the same answer, by the way, back then as I have now. Why'd you do that? How could you? I don't know. Yeah. I didn't know. But it was fear-based. I know that. You know. And so, you know, so we don't, you know, we don't do something about the way I feel. If I don't do something about the way I feel, I'm never going to be able to stay stopped. And that's what the doctor was talking about, this restless cerebral discontent and the ease and comfort that comes at once from a drink or a drug. And then, boom, we're off to the races, causing all kind of havoc in everybody's life, including our own. And so the normies are looking at us going, "Just stop. You know, just stop that shit. You know, like, And that whole thing, you do it for her, do it for the kids, do it, you know, my mother begging me, you know, he talks about, you know, frothy emotional appeal. You know, the doctor talks about can hardly suffice. They begged us, begging us, please. My God, my mother would say, you're killing me. You know, you're killing me. I can't sleep. Please stop. And so why can't I stay stopped? And the doctor talks about it. Restless, irritable, and discontent. Where does that come from? Well, that's what Bill's talking about, that spiritual sickness, you know, this emotional illness that we're suffering from. That if we don't treat that, you just can't stay stopped. Look, there was times, you know, it talks about, we always talk about an obsession as an idea that overcomes the truth, right? And Bill Wilson talks about this black curtain that comes down between us and the truth, you know, and in his story, he talks about that business opportunity he had in the Big Book. He doesn't expand it in the Big Book, but later he talks about that story, and if you've seen the documentary, it's in that documentary, where he talks about that moonshine going around the room, and he refuses it twice. You know, no, I signed a contract. If I drink, I'm out, and I'm not drinking. And then somebody says something stupid like, do you know what that is? That there is Jersey Lightning. That's the best moonshine this side of the Mississippi. And he goes, damn it, I've never had any Jersey Lightning. And he says, his words are after that, he says, it was as if a black curtain came down between me and the truth. You know. So we talk about the insanity of alcoholism being the inability to see the truth. I want to tell you something. I knew the truth and still did it. I knew where it was going. F it. Right? I mean, there's people here who know what I'm talking about. It just got so painful being me, because you don't know how it feels to be me. And if you knew, if you felt like I felt, you'd drink too. You'd medicate too. And it just became so overwhelming that feeling blocked out. And you know what? There was some time, you don't promise a judge that you're never going to drink again and drink again. You know, I mean, it was too painful. And I knew where it was going. I knew it was, the book talks about that. Sometimes we just go out and deliberately get drunk. So somehow I got to treat that issue. And that's really, to me, what this fourth step is. The rest of the steps to me is about treating that, right? I needed something as powerful as that. And I didn't believe you had it. I really didn't. I share with you guys, I was tricked into the second step. You know, I was like, you know, I didn't have a, somebody said to me, you know what, get up in the morning, pray, ask God to keep away from drink, and thank him at night. And then I shared this with you guys, Camper John, and Camper John said to me that, you know, guess what, you're not going to make it through the day, so just pray to get through the hour. And the next hour, and then the next hour, and then the next, and you got 24 hours you got to get through, pray to get through the hours. And I started doing that, and I started getting results. And I started thinking maybe there was something to this thing. And that, and the power, coupled with the power of the fellowship. But how are you going to connect me? How are you going to, what are you going to give me that's as powerful as that whiskey? What are you going to give me that's as powerful as that dope? You know, what are you going to give? What are you going to do internally to me? And it becomes a matter of trust, doesn't it? It becomes just a matter of willingness that I don't want to go back there. And it's based in tragedy. It's based in total tragedy. That was so bad, I don't want to go back there. I'm willing to listen to what you have to do. I'm willing to follow some directions and see what happens. And that's really where I was at. I was just willing to do, you know what, if this will work, I'll give it a shot. I don't know what you got here that's as powerful as that alcohol, but I'll give this a shot. And that's why I started a fourth step. That's why I did a fourth step, you know. And, you know, talking about resentments being a number one offender, that's true. And by the way, I'm going to get sidetracked for a second. You know, we always talk about relationships in early recovery, you know, and that's why you don't want to get in relationships in early recovery, right? Because relationships cause resentments. They just do, you know, they just, and it's just natural, right? Because I'm sensitive, you know, I'm a very sensitive guy, and you can hurt my feelings very easily. Matter of fact, my wife, Shannon, some of you guys know Shannon, but my, and by the way, I'm not anti-relationships in Alcoholics Anonymous. Two people walking this spiritual path is a beautiful thing. I don't know if there's anything more beautiful than two people walking the same path together. Now, one of them gets off the path, it's tragic, you know, and that can be a problem. But I get to share this walk with somebody who's walking the same path as I am, and that's really cool. That is really cool. She gets me, I get her. She gets when the phone rings at 2 a.m, you know, I don't have somebody going, "You really?" You know, she gets it, you know, and I get it when she's on the phone all damn night long and, you know, with her girls, and, you know, I get it. And so it's a beautiful thing, you know. But we don't handle resentments well in early recovery. I don't handle resentments well many years into this thing. I just don't. I'm not good with feelings. I emosh. I told you guys that. I'm an emosher, you know. I think and I emosh. You know, that's just the way it is. And then I react based on that emotion. And you usually dictate the emotion. I usually let you do that, you know. And so this is like Wednesday night, last Friday night. We were on our way to, what the hell day is this? Yeah. Last Friday night, we're on our way to one of the fraction resorts that we take a meeting to, right? And she's freezing in the car, in the truck. I have my tundra, and she's freezing in the truck. She goes, "Damn, I'm always freezing in this truck." And I go, "Okay." And I turn the air conditioner, I adjust the air conditioner, and I say, "You know, you got your own little switch over there if you want to mess with that." And she says, and I say to her, "That's funny, man. You know, I'm just trying to make conversation." I said, "Funny how, you know, I'm always freezing in the house, and you're hot, and I'm always hot in the car, and you're always freezing, you know." And I was just making conversation. I didn't know where that was going. And, you know, and she looks over and goes, "That's because you're frugal." Right? Frugal. Like, now I'm happy. I'm so in love. You know, thank you for putting her in my life. And now the resentment machine turns on. And I go, "Did she just call me a cheap fuck?" You know? And I think she did. I still kind of smiling, you know, like, so I'm just cold in the house. It has nothing to do with money. I'm just freezing in there. And she goes, "Yeah, you're cheap. You know, you're just worried about the electric bill, you know." And it was just, she wasn't, I don't think she was being mean-spirited, but I didn't talk the whole rest of the ride, you know. So she just said it's all about the money, and I'm cheap, and we're only talking like 1 degree, you know. But that's the resentment machine, right? It comes on, and I start replaying this stuff, and, you know, next thing I'm like, "Jeez, it's going to be hard to split all this shit up, you know." At this point, it's going to be tough, you know? But that's where I go. I mean, I just like, I don't need this shit, you know? It just, I don't know why, you know? It just, and here's how I diffused it. I said, "You know, this would be a great topic for Thursday night, because, like, I'm in resentments. You know, I can use this example as how somebody sick would turn what you said into a divorce or something down the road, right?" But that's where I went. And she said, "Yeah." And she started laughing. I started like, "Yeah, it would be funny." And I said, "Yeah, I think I'll share that Thursday night. How stupid that is, you know, that I think you called me cheap, you know." She called me cheap for sure. But that's what we do. I mean, you know, that's a resentment, right? Refeel, right? That's what it means, to refeel, to feel it again, you know? And somebody says something to us that bothers us, whether it's real or imagined. You know, I mean, it doesn't matter. I one of my favorite stories I like to tell, and really that's all I got, by the way, is a bunch of stories, you know? And that's all we all have, right, is a bunch of stories. That's what this whole book is a bunch of, it's Bill's story. The whole book is Bill's story, you know? The whole book is Bill's story in the first 100, you know? That's his story, you know? And so I'm in a meeting, and I share with you guys, I'm from this Tough Love group, it's called the Boca Boys Club. I was about 5 years sober when I connected with this group, and they weren't in Boca and they weren't boys. I don't know what the hell the deal was with all that, but they were in Deerfield Beach and a bunch of old men, you know. And eventually they moved to Boca, but they were Boca boys way before they moved to Boca, and I think they wanted to be Boca boys, but But they taught me how to behave in AA, and I shared this with you guys before. You know, they taught me about wearing a collar when I spoke or a chair. You know, if they saw you take a phone out, they would call you on it. I mean, they would stop the meeting, put that freaking phone away, or go outside. I mean, they would just shut you down right there. And, you know, pagers, at that time it was pagers. You know, if your pager went off during a meeting, man, you were called to task. And just told how to behave, how to respect Alcoholics Anonymous as the sacred place that it is, you know. And those guys were those kind of guys. I kind of tell my guys the same thing. Look, if you're chairing, wear a collar. Don't mess with that phone when you're in a meeting. No crosstalk. No crosstalk during a meeting. Respect the speaker. You know, that kind of thing. And that's kind of how I was raised. And so I'm breaking the freaking rule, and I'm talking to one of my guys, you know, while the speaker's talking. And I was quiet. I wasn't really bothering anybody. And some old-timer shushed my ass, you know. Like he said, shh. And I said, I didn't hear another word in the meeting. Yeah. Not another freaking word, man. This guy just embarrassed me in front of my guys in my home group. It's my home group, right? And the Deerfield Beach Study Group, by the way, is my home group. Monday nights, 7:30. And I start replaying that stuff, and I get outside, and I'm pissed, you know. Here's what it went. It went from shh, when somebody asked me, what's up with you and that dude? And I said, he told me to shut up during the meeting, you know. He really told you to shut up? And I said, yeah, he told me to shut up right in front of everybody, you know. And the more I'm talking, somebody else comes up to me and says, what dude told you to shut up? I said, he told me to shut the fuck up, man, you know. Yeah, shut the fuck up. He dropped an F-bomb on you? Yeah, I'm pretty sure he dropped an F-bomb on me, you know. Yeah. Just where my head goes, you know, just as we replay it, it gets worse and worse and worse, and I become the victim, you know, and then you guys get on my team, and then we become the get-even guys, you know, and they like, dude, if that was my home group, I'd get a different home group, and I should, you know, I think, you know, who needs these guys anyway, you know, I mean, geez, I've only been coming here for 15 years, you know, they need me more than I need them, you know. That's where I go. You know, I just, the resentment. I mean, love Charlie Parmalee was my idol. Charlie Parmalee was my mentor. And Charlie used to talk about it just like a football game, you know, and I'm a big Steeler fan. And, you know, I raised during the Bradshaw Swan days. And, you know, Lynn Swan was an acrobat when it came to catching the football. And he would just go up and away, and Bradshaw would put that ball where nobody else could get it. But the Haynes brothers in Oakland would get underneath Swan and cut him out and take his legs out from under him, and he'd hit the ground, and you'd think for sure he got hurt, you know, and then Charlie used to always say that the guy up in the announcing booth had a resentment machine, and he used to just bounce him up and down, you know, let's look at that again, you know, and this time we're going to slow it down, and then they'd look at it again, and the second time you look at it, he says, shit, he's dead, you know, he ain't never getting up. Third time you look at it, oh my God, he's crippled, you know, and each time you look at it slower and in more detail, it becomes worse and worse and worse, And the magic of Charlie's analogy was that either they pump some air into Lynn Swan and put him back in the lineup, or they cart him off the field. But either way, just like life, the game goes on, you know. And that's what happens. Those people move on, and then I'm stuck in that damn resentment all freaking day, week, months. I've resented dead people, you know. I've had dead people running my freaking life for years. You know, just can't get it out of my head. I'm powerless over it. I am powerless over it. I guess I like that victim role sometimes. You know, I get comfortable in being, I start feeling the self-pity, and I get you on my team. Yeah, I know. If that happened to me, I'd feel the same way. And what amazes me is that although it may have hurt the first time, it hurts worse after they leave. You know, they're done and they've moved on with their life. And each time I replay it, it hurts even worse. And I just get sicker and sicker. And in the end, I'm just pissed off at myself for letting you rent space in my head. But I can't let it go. You know, it's just no way to get rid of it. And, you know, Bill says it actually has the power to kill. Because there's the emotion. There's the emotion that I drink over right there. I've got to find a way to eliminate that emotion. I can't live with it. That's, he talks about that emotional barometer. You know, I can will myself sober. All right, so I'm a little bit more restless. I can still will myself sober here. Willpower's working just well. I don't know about right here. I'm starting to feel a little stressed out, you know. And then at some point, it becomes so overwhelming being me that I fall prey. I need some relief. And I might go in other directions first. I might go spending some money or buy another car to feel better that day or buy a new watch or something to make me feel good. But eventually that wears off and I need that drink, you know. And some of it's just imagined. Some of it, nobody even shushed me. You know, I was doing a step series at the 101 one night, and there's some girls that are sitting at the table, like right in front of me, like right the same, the podium, someone's connected to that table. And all four of them got up during my talk and left. You know, I don't care, you know, but shit, what the hell did I say, you know? I mean, I was just like, I mean, there's 100 people that stayed, but these four got up. You know, disrespectful, if nothing else, right? And I'm going, what did I say? I mean, I can't believe somebody would do that in the middle of somebody. How disrespectful is that, you know? And I'm telling you, my rest of my talk, I don't even know what I said, you know? And all I can think about was, damn it, you know? And I'm at the 101, it's on a Friday night, and that's where my wife has her girls at a halfway house near there. They do a meeting. And so I leave the 101, and I'm going to meet my wife, and I just can't believe that these girls got up in front of me and left. And I get to the halfway house, and it's anniversary night, and they left because they wanted to present a medallion to the girl that was picking up at that halfway house. And I see them both there, and goes, oh, Pat, sorry, we had to leave her, but we wanted to give her this medallion. And I go, oh, no problem. You know, I was... no, I didn't even notice. You left? Oh, yeah. I wish I could tell you I'm all over that, but it makes me work this thing harder, I think, than other people. I mean, you know, I talk about chasing this thing. I'm still chasing this thing. I am. I'm still chasing it. And you know, we'll talk a lot about this when we get to the 10th step. It's just this constant inventory, this constant self-examination that takes place in my life that's forced on me because I'm uncomfortable with where I'm at, because people have a powerful effect on me. And I can't do it. I just can't do it. And the resentment inventory is all about finding out the truth about that, is seeing the truth in the people that we're pissed off at, the people that we feel like hurt us, the people that did us wrong. It's about seeing the truth in that. I think I shared this last week, but if you're like me and you can't remember the page you just read, anybody? Right? You know, like you read a paragraph and go, shit, you know? I was thinking about tomorrow, you know, I totally lost that. If somebody would have asked me what you just read, I wouldn't even be able to tell you. You know, I couldn't tell you where. I got to go back and reread it now, and hence why I do service work and I'm not an educator, you know. It's an ADD thing, you know. Thank God I grew up back in the 60s and 70s, or they would have medicated my ass and probably stole my gift from me, you know, and because my gift is my energy, and I'm glad that I have the kind of just I'm like a rocket ship when I leave the house in the morning, and it's not medicated. But you miss the instructions, right? There's like one paragraph where all the instructions for the damn resentments are right there. And if you miss that paragraph, you miss the whole point of the exercise, you know. Some of it is really important. And it says we listed the people, institutions, and principles to whom we were angry, right? And a list, it means top to bottom, not left to right, you know. And they do that purposely. And just to talk about the mechanics of it for a second, they do it purposely because we want to inventory it. We don't want to relive it. You know, so and if you go left to right, you're reliving it, and it becomes work, and it becomes emotional, and then it does become painful. You know, so it's about a list, just up top to bottom, just list the people that you're pissed off at. You know, second column, why am I mad at these people? You know, and the third column is how was I affected? You know, and I think, and look, we talk about it's bullshit. We're taking their inventory. You know, I mean, I don't know why they call it our inventory, because we take our inventory later in a couple of other columns, but we're really talking, because it looks like the perpetrator of the crime and how it damaged me. That's really what it looks like, right? And that's what it is. You know, and we're looking at how was I affected? What instinctual drive? Because this whole program is, and you hear it tons from me from here on in, it's all about the instinctual drives. It's all about the social instinct. It's all about the security instinct. It's all about the sex instinct. It's all about how you affect those things, because that's all that's important to me, to be liked and accepted, to have nice stuff, to have somebody depend on me or become dependent on somebody. And obviously the sex instinct, right? A powerful force. You know, and it's all about how those instinctual drives are affected, or what I was doing to satisfy those instinctual drives. One of the two. And we look at both of those. We look at both areas of that. But in the resentment and the fear inventory, it's about how were those instinctual drives affected? Did they affect what people think of me or what I think of myself? Did they affect my material security instinct? During the divorce, did she take the house? Did she take the car? Did it affect my sex instinct? Hidden or acceptable? Either one. And all they're talking about is hidden when they're talking about the sex instinct. There's things I don't want other people to know. You know, things that I'm hiding. Things that I'd rather keep to myself. You know, it doesn't have to be anything off the charts. To me, I didn't have to get much of that on paper. When I looked at that, when I wrote that inventory, I realized how stupid most of it was, you know. And like I said, how could you resent somebody who passed away 10 years ago? You know, like, that's crazy. You know, how could I started seeing the truth in it already. How could I resent somebody for having me arrested when I assaulted them? You know, how could I resent the police for arresting me when they were called to the scene? It wasn't, let's go get Pat Knight, you know. let's go harass. It wasn't. It was 911. Boom, we have to respond. Oh, you assaulted her, we're arresting you. That was it. You know, and 95% of them just drop away. You go, holy crap, how stupid is that? That I'm letting these people rent space in my head. There were a few, there's a handful that would not go away. You know? And they give us tools right there in that step. And that's why it takes such a leap of faith to go into these steps without knowing what the gift is going to be or what the answer is going to be or the effect it's going to have on us, because immediately they give us tools to handle the resentments, and it's called prayer. You know, we asked, big book code for we prayed. You know, anytime you see we asked, it's we prayed. You know, and a couple of times he does say we pray. You know, but most of the time it's we ask God. You know, and to me this is, it says we look at it from a totally different angle. You know, instead of playing the victim for a second, you know, how possibly did my actions provoke them? You know, and the miracle is that for a moment, we stop thinking about us and we start thinking about them. Perhaps they're spiritually sick too. Not just they're spiritually. Perhaps they're spiritually sick too, like we are. You know? Perhaps there's something going on in their life that's causing them trauma, that's causing them some kind of anxiety, that's causing them to retaliate also, or to lash out at us. You know? And he gives us a tool to deal with that. You know, to me, this is the first spiritual experience in my life that took place when I started praying for somebody I disliked. Now that is a personality change sufficient to recover from alcoholism or drug addiction. That's different. Who would have thought of that? First off, who would have thought of doing an inventory? I never even dawned on me to do an inventory until I got here. You know, to look at myself. And then pray for somebody I disliked? Who knew? You know? That as soon as I would do that, as soon as I would show, probably the most powerful act of love you could show for another person is to pray for them, that the God in me would connect with the God in them, the brokenness in me would connect with the brokenness in them, right? Namaste, right? that my soul connects with theirs, and all of a sudden I see them in a whole different light. And then the next thing is spiritual experience, spiritual awakening, personality change. I wonder if I could be helpful. Holy shit. There's a change. I wonder if I could be helpful to this person in any way. Because they're sick too. And you start wondering, what's going on? Instead of playing the victim, we immediately say, I wonder if there's anything I could do to help. I wonder if there's anything going on in their life. And it changes everything. It eliminates most of the resentments in my life. It eliminates most of the conflict in my life because I'm no longer being a victim. I'm wondering if I could be helpful. It's not about me anymore. It's about them. Yeah. My wife and I were at Bonefish Max in Margate one night, and we're sitting there having dinner. And the waitress comes up and just throws the menus on the table. You know, I'll be back. You know, right? And I looked at my wife. I go, "Damn, you know, bad day there, huh?" She goes, "Yeah, yeah, that's bad." And she comes back, and I'm telling you. The old me, I'm going to write to the manager, right? I mean, that's what you do. I mean, this is bullshit. I'm a paying customer here. Somebody treat me like that. That's, you know, that's just not right. And it isn't. And it isn't right. That's their job, is to be nice to me, right? Whether they're having a good or bad day or not, it don't matter to me. Well, it does matter to me now. Because you got two recovered people sitting there in the booth. And she comes back, and I said, "Are you okay?" And she said, "No." And I said, "Sit down." And she sat down with my wife and I for about 5 minutes and talked about how her day was going and what was going on in her life. Yeah. There's a personality change sufficient to recover. I'm not a victim. You know, I wonder if I could be helpful to her. And we were. Best service I've ever had in my life. Right? She left there. She had a smile on her face. Changed somebody's day. Changed somebody's day. And now I'm not resentful. And she's having a better day. Yeah. But that's how this thing works. That's the change. That's like, to me, the first spiritual experience in the book. You know, that just changed. It was a game changer for me. That's where my life began to change when I stopped playing victim. Now, I could not. There were a couple. My father, I was still pissed. I had a hard time. Look, some children are victims. Yeah. They're not responsible for what took place, you know. And so it's hard to let go of some of that stuff. You know, my ex-wife was just unreasonable, damn it. And I could see, I could see that it was my fault, but I am the ice cream truck. Right now, if you just came here, you're going, "What the hell, the ice cream truck?" See, that's what happened to me. I kept hearing this guy talk about an ice cream truck. Until he explained to me about the ice cream truck, I know he saw it. I'm not going to tell you about the ice cream truck. You're just going to have to find out, you know. But I was the ice cream truck. I needed that house. I needed the equity in that house. That was who I saved all. I worked a lot of years to get that equity in that house. I needed that car. I needed that stuff. And I had a hard time letting go of that kind of stuff. And then somebody told me I needed to read a story in the back of the book called Freedom from Bondage. 552 is the prayer, but 551 to the end of the story is incredible. I wouldn't even read it, by the way, at first. I found out a woman wrote it. I said, "Bullshit, I'm not reading." You know, that's just a trick. You're just trying. I'm not reading that. But I was finally in enough pain, and I just could not let go of that stuff. You know, I could not let go of it. And people were telling me, "Dude, you need to let go. You're going to lose it if you don't let go. You know, you might lose it anyway. What's the difference? Let it go. You don't need the house. She needs a house. There's two kids there. What, are you going to kick your kids out of the house? What kind of father are you? Pay your damn child support and let your kids live in their bedrooms." But boy, I was having problems. Yeah. But those are the kind of men that were in my life at that time. Yeah. And I started reading it, and really what it talks about is praying for that person that you dislike for 2 weeks straight. And it talks about eventually, as you pray for them for 2 weeks straight, ask that God give them everything that would make them happy. Ask them everything that you would want to give to them. You know, no, I mean, my prayer started out with give her exactly what she deserves. I mean, that's kind of, you know. But within 2 weeks, I'm telling you, I was praying for her to be happy, even if I wasn't part of her life. You know, even if I didn't get the house, because it was consuming me. And I knew if I didn't let it go, that conflict was going to cause me to pick up. I can't do the emotional stuff very long. I just don't. I'll act out. I'll find other ways to medicate. But eventually it's leading me back to a drink. A number one offender, man. Number one offender. Kills more alcoholics than anything else. But then Bill goes on to say that, but fear is the underlying corroding thread behind it all. Right? And by the way, there's two more columns I didn't talk about where it talks about how do you keep them from coming back, is that you look at what you did. How did I start the ball rolling? What could I have done differently? You know, I mean, look, the first three columns to me were eye-opening, especially with my ex-wife. You know, I started looking at that, like she had me arrested, she took the house, she wanted a divorce. The turnaround is, what did you do to set that ball rolling? As soon as I got that on paper, I went, oh my God, it's all my fault. You know, it didn't make me feel any better, by the way, about losing the house at that time. But it was surely, I saw that it was my fault. And that happens with almost all of them. Once we start looking at the effect that we have on other people, how we can bring out the worst in other people, how I can bring out the best in you, I can bring out the worst in you. I'm a big Rhonda Byrne's fan. I'm a big Secret guy. I read it every day. You know, I believe in frequencies. You know, I'm just that person. I know that whatever frequency I'm putting out there is probably what I'm going to get back. You know, and I get that. You know, that's like my thing. I read that thing religiously, you know. And I can bring out the worst in you too, by the way. I'm good at that. Sarcasm is one of my favorite assets. Most people don't think so, but it's cutting with humor. You know, it's assassination with that's funny. You know, and I think it is anyway. And I can bring out the worst in you with that, and then I'll tell you, oh, I was just kidding. You know, and after I just get you into a rage, I'll say, oh no, you took that serious, you know, I was just bullshitting, you know. But fear's behind even all the resentments. It was always about fear, you know, fear you're going to find out what I did, fear I'm not going to get what I want, you know, fear I'm going to lose what I got, you know, it's all fear. That whole resentment sheet, when you really analyze it, was about fear. It was all fear driven, you know. And with my guys on the fear inventory, most of them, we list them, we get the fear inventory done, and I look at them, I said, read them top to bottom. How many are right now? None, usually. I'm afraid of the future. I'm afraid if somebody's going to find out about the past, usually. Yeah. I mean, the fear inventories are actually kind of humorous if you really look at them right, right? Like fear of relationships. Fear I'm going to lose my relationship. Fear I'm not going to get the job. Fear I'm going to lose the job. We're just tough people. I mean, we're just grounded in fear, right? It's hard to like hate people but not like being alone. That's a tough place to be, you know? And that's kind of me. Like, I don't like most people, but geez, I can't stand being alone, you know? And that's a hard way to live, you know? It just, people would annoyed me, you know, because they didn't want to do what I wanted them to do. You know, I was trying to control the world, and that was really the deal. But most of the fear is imagined. I mean, there's some legitimate stuff, you know, fear my children might get hurt. Yeah, I mean, that's probably a healthy fear. Maybe you'll take care of them, you know? You know, it's fear. You know, fear drives me constantly. I mean, what fear has done for me was cause me to prepare. The fear that of me speaking causes me to at least look for a starting point before I get up here. You know, at least start the ball rolling somehow. At least have a plan and a destination. You know, now none of that ever happens the way I want it to. You know, because there's the three talks, right? There's the talk I'm going to have, the talk I had, and the talk I should have had. And that's just the way it's always going to be, you know. I go home and say, oh, I forgot to say this. I should have said that, you know. It just doesn't bother me like it used to, you know. I get it now. It's just, it's a leap of faith when you get up here. And, you know, we were talking about that before the meeting. It's just, you know, you have a destination and you say a word with a leap of faith that the rest of the words that come out will bring you to that destination, somewhere near it anyway. And usually that's what takes place. And so the plan is right, useless, but it quiets the fear, you know. And this one day at a time thing is Bill's talking about emotionally. If you have a job interview next week, you need to prepare for the damn job interview. You know, you don't wait till the day, because I only live in the day. You know, you don't wait till the day of the job interview and prepare, you know. You want to stop the worry, prepare today for next week's job interview, right? And it quiets the fear. It calms it down. You know, we'll talk about this when we get to step 11, but I have a pad and paper in my truck, my van, my car. And if something's renting space in my head, I write it down. You know, I don't want to deal with it all day long. It's out in the future. Why should I worry about it now? Let me write it down, and tonight when I'm doing my nightly inventory, I'll look at it, you know, and see if there's something I should do to prepare for it. And we'll talk a lot about the nightly inventory when we get to 11. And it stops that worry. I can't do fear either. You know, fear is another emotion that I don't do well. You know, but I've learned how to deal with it. Prayer. Right, we ask God again for the courage to walk through it. Fear, courage is not the absence of fear; it's the ability to walk through the fear. It's the ability to do this, even though you're scared to death to do it. It's that leap of faith. You know, it's doing things that are uncomfortable because you know there's a reward on the other side. And it just and that comes from sober references. It comes from experience. You know, and that you know that's why you never hear me say my sober date. It's not relevant. It's just not relevant. Very rare do I say it. I say it one time, and that's in my story, the day I came into AA, and that's the only time I say it. Because there's people here that have a month that are more sober than me today. It just depends on how I acted today. But what makes time important is that you've weathered storms. You know, the guys that have time have gone through the health issues. They've gone through the relationship losses. They've gone through the job changes, and they didn't drink or drug over them. And they have sober references that they can look back. And I look back and I go, I got through that. I can get through this. You know, what tools do I use to get through it? And to me, that's all that time means. I mean, sober is relevant. I mean, you get up in every morning and you recommit, you know, and you recommit to this way of life. And if you do that, you get through it without conflict. And if you don't, you don't. You know, and it's the thing that I commit to is I'm going to work this thing today, and I'm not picking up a drink today. And that I do 1 hour at a time, 1 day at a time. But the rest of it is how, you know, at night I look and say, how well did I do this thing today? And I want to tell you something. There's some newcomers that certain days did it better than me. You know, but look, we got a tools that we can correct that, and hopefully we can show some restraint somewhere in the future and stay on that path, you know. And that it takes practice. It just takes practice. And you know, the last inventory and probably the most important inventory they ask us to do is a sex inventory. And thank God we're not the moral police here. You know, that's not what we do here. And we're not talking about the sex act. We're really talking about one question, and that's, is it selfish or not? You know, are you a selfish self-seeker driven by fear, self-delusion, and self-pity? Is that what's driving your sex instinct? Then you need to take a look at it. I mean, it's not about the act. It's about what's the motive behind it, you know, and that it's really who did I hurt? What did I do? What instinct was I trying to fulfill when I hurt them? And we all probably want to check the sex things, but the truth is it was less about the sex and it was more about the social for me. It was more about the security. You know, I'll share with you guys today. I wanted somebody dependent. I picked dependent women. You know, I don't want a free thinker. You know, I want somebody confident and, you know, self-supporting. I want somebody freaking dependent, you know, because I'm an ass, you know. I want somebody that needs to be, I want somebody to say, I need you, you know, not I want you, I need you. That's what I wanted. Right? I don't even use that word anymore. You know, that's the relationship I have today. It took a long time to get there, you know, a few tries. You know, and a lot of work in this program to find out I'm a taker even in sobriety, That's a tough reality. That's a tough pill to swallow. And that took me to get divorced in recovery, to realize I'm still a taker in relationships. You know? And my wife and I today are together because we want to be together, not because we need each other. She don't need me. She don't need me for anything. She's self-supporting. She wants to be with me, and I'm on that same page. You know, I'm okay. I spent a year and a half alone before I even started dating, once I realized I was dating the devil. You know, and I got right with me and God, and realized that I had something to, you know, maybe I should think about being the right person rather than finding the freaking right person. You know, maybe I should think about being a giver rather than a taker. Because let me tell you something, successful relationships require two givers and two forgivers. That's what they require. And if you have two takers in that relationship, it ain't going to work. You have one taker, it ain't going to work. It takes a lot of compromise. It takes being okay with yourself. It takes trust. I didn't trust because I'm not trustworthy. Yeah, that's the punishment of the person who cheats. They can't trust anybody. That's the punishment of the thief. Everybody's ripping you off. Everybody's out to get you. That's how we get punished. We don't trust anybody. But they're talking about, what are my motives behind the sex instinct? Yeah. And that's the inventory. You know, who did I hurt? What did I do? What instinct was I trying to satisfy? I was more scared about the sex act. I wanted my friends to think I was having sex with her. That was fine. You know, that would be fine. You know, they think I'm doing it. That's cool. You know, give me a little high five, you know. I was afraid of the sex. What if I fail? I'll have to kill myself. You know, what if I don't measure up? Oh, my gosh, remember, she laughs, you know. Oh, I couldn't take that. I'd be suicidal. You know, it's just, that's just where I was, you know. And it was less about the sex act than it was about the security instinct and what you guys thought of me, you know. And they're asking us to reel that in. And they give us three prayers for sex, you know. It was one for resentment, one for fear, three for sex, you know. And it's about reeling that in. It's, you know, bringing it in, you know. The measure of our defects, right? The measure of our defects are where we've taken those instinctual drives beyond God's intention for them, right? That the instinctual drives are God-given, good, necessary for survival. We all want to be part of something or be in charge of something. We all need a house to live in and shelter. We all need a job to provide. The sex instinct, if we didn't have that, we wouldn't procreate. They're all God-given. It's just that I find so much pleasure in them that I can't get enough of them. And I just destroy relationships for brief moments of pleasure. Just seemed like a good idea at the time, and alcohol would give me permission to do it, and then it would give me absolution the next morning. Yeah. And I've destroyed beautiful relationships. I've destroyed people's lives because of moments of pleasure. Yeah. How could you? Yeah. I don't know. It's all I had. I didn't know. I don't know. Yeah. And it's that's what they're asking. Reel that in where God wanted it to be. Yeah. We don't judge here. We don't care. We just, it's, you know, look, if you're, the deep down within every one of us is the fundamental idea of God. You judge. You know it. You know what's right and what's wrong. You right here, the soul, the conscience, the part of you that knows that it knows that it knows. You be the judge. Because if you are feeling that, if you're feeling that knot in your stomach, you got a chance of picking up. You got a chance to drink, because it's that uncomfortability. It's that guilt, that remorse, that shame, that anger, that fear that I have to eliminate in my life to stay sober. That's the spiritual malady. That is the spiritual malady. You know, I don't judge anybody. I mean, I don't care if you go on a porn site. I don't, you know, it's your call. You know, how's that feel? You know, I don't, you know, look, you're not the only one. It's a $50 billion industry. You know what I mean? I know I didn't spend that much money. But if you're staying home with your pants on the floor all day, you better take a look at that shit. You know what I mean? I'm just saying. I'm not judging anybody. I'm just saying. You know, Charlie used to always say, if two people want to do whatever they want to do and they're both comfortable with it, have at it. It's when you're forcing somebody to do something they don't want to do where it becomes conflictual, right? That's where the conflict starts, right? He used the analogy, if two people want to have sex hanging upside down from a tree, let them have it. But if you're forcing her to have sex upside down, hanging from the tree, it's a problem. You know? You just have to be comfortable. I didn't say it. It was Charlie. Enough of that sex stuff, right? I've gone off the rails. It's just about reeling these drives in. Get them where they were intended to be so that we're no longer in conflict with everybody. You know, it's being comfortable with who I am and what I'm doing, right? The spiritual disease that Bill was talking about was anger, resentment, fear, guilt, remorse, shame, manifesting itself in selfish and self-centered people, manifesting itself in takers. And somehow we have to reel that in. Right? One quick story. When I met my wife, it was not my idea, but I was told by my new sponsor, and I'll share how that came about. But I met my wife. I asked her if we could take sex off the table. You want a healthy relationship? Start your relationship off like that. Can we take it off the table? My wife probably breathed a sigh of relief. You know, and we spent time getting to know each other first before we slept with each other. That was not the way I did relationships before. The whole goal was to satisfy the sex instinct and the social instinct and the security instinct all in one shot. The whole goal was to sleep with them and then see if I liked them enough to marry them. Right? You'd be amazed if you start the other way around how great it is to consummate a relationship. You know, when you get to have some fun with somebody, you get to know somebody, and then it ends there. It's a whole different deal. I had no idea. It took a lot of trust to go down that road. But look, if you want a healthy relationship, guys, ladies, take it off the table. You know, we took it off the table for a month at least. You know, and I've got to know somebody. You know, I don't want to go down the same road that I did when I failed in two relationships, where if you'll sleep with me, I'll marry you. That was just the deal, you know. And then I'll get you to like me and you know, change you to what I need you to be. And that's always been the way it's been. But this, and look, this, and my relationship is something I would have never imagined. I would have never imagined being in a relationship that I'm in today, where all I can think about is giving, and I don't need anything. You know, and when two people are on that page, it's an amazing, amazing gift. Thanks for letting me be here tonight. Sorry if I crossed the line. I don't know why I bring this book. I think it's like my whoopee.
Thanks, Pat.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Pat. And let's have Ryan for the secretary's report.
Hi, I'm Ryan, and I'm a recovered alcoholic secretary. In keeping with the seventh tradition, which states that every group shall be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions, the baskets are now going around. And I've asked Artie to read the recovered statement. We read this notice to explain why many people in this group identify as recovered rather than recovering, and what it exactly means to be a recovered alcoholic.
I feel like Pat missing Rick. I'm like a young Pat. Want to read this one?
Yeah.
All right. So I'm recovered. We are not cured of alcoholism. Recovered, but not cured. That presents a conflict to some alcoholics. If we were cured, we would be able to drink responsibly. No, we are not cured. The allergic reaction to alcohol will remain with us for our lifetime. But we have been restored to sanity. That was the problem. The main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than his body. We are now saying where alcohol is concerned. Consequently, we have recovered.
Thanks, 1940s style big book sponsorship from the forward to the second edition of Alcoholics Anonymous. Of alcoholics who came to AA and really tried, 50% got sober at once and remained that way. 25% sobered up after some relapses, and among the remainder, those who stayed on with AA showed improvement. What we've seen, felt, come to believe, and experience is that God has not changed over time, and neither should the sacred approach back to his loving arms. The statistics above suggest a 75% success rate. Can I see a show of hands of recovered alcoholics? Nice. And then is there anybody here that needs a sponsor? If you could just raise your hand. Awesome. Could you just stand up real quick for me? Thanks. Any of the ladies in the room that want to help get these girls back to God? Please join us Monday nights for the Big Book Study meeting where the book comes alive. Fellowship is at 6:30, and the Big Book Study starts at 7:15. And we have CDs, mugs, and large print Big Books, little red books, and Big Book dictionaries for sale in the back. If you're interested. And then we do have some announcements. So the Broward County Intergroup for Alcoholics Anonymous, there's office hours there and ways to get in touch with them. You can get medallions, literature, pretty much anything you need. There's also some volunteer opportunities. You've got the AA's Got Talent, the Intergroup Banquet, and an ice cream social. That sounds fun. AA's Got Talent, dust off the tap shoes because it's coming up in February, so get the routine ready. The gratitude dinner is tomorrow, and the theme this year is the best is yet to come. If you have any questions, there was some information down at the bottom there. Also, on Sunday, we have the intergroup picnic at Snyder Park, and there's going to be games, there's going to be music, food, and face painting. And is that it? Oh, and then Gratitude Days is the Gulfstream Group Gratitude Days is going to be Friday, November 9th through November 11th. There's a ton of speakers. Also, another reminder about the 75-foot no-smoking vape zone in front of the doors. It's an invisible 75 feet, so just try and gauge it. There's the Boy Scouts here, so... you don't want the Boy Scouts trying to put you out when you light up. So thank you for your cooperation on that one. And we meet every Thursday starting promptly at 7:15. And we ask that you be courteous and ready to begin at the sound of the bells. Thank you very much. See you next week.
Thanks, Ryan. Thank you, Ryan. We have tonight's session and all past speaker podcasts online for free at alcoholicsandgod.org. I'd like to invite everyone to our Monday night Big Book study. And those whom wish to thank the speaker, please line up down the center aisle. Let's take a moment of silence and close with the Lord's Prayer. Our Father. Thank you.
Hi, Michael Chase. Here's that song you've been asking me for a million years. I finally pulled it out the corners of my mind, and here you go. Is lifted. I see the light. Count my blessings when I go to sleep at night. And I dream now. Fear has left me and I'm standing tall. A pile of bricks now lies where once there stood a wall that I hid behind. For all this time. Sometimes it takes a burning bush or a great white light to set you right. Well, my eyes don't cry now, and I'm out to dry. Pity party's over, the guest of honor has arrived, and he's on my side. For the first time in my life. Are green now, growing vines. They twist and turn each way. Flowers blooming all the time right outside my door. Like never before. I had to change everything to realize that today is the best day of my life. Broken man, I travel far and wide through the great divide, through his own heart, yeah. Well, I have a life today when it give away and it's just about to start. Show up and plug in my guitar, and I play my songs, and people sing along, and stomp their feet and raise their arms. And here in this moment that we share, nothing could come in. Lessons when I go to sleep at night and I dream now. Yeah, I dream now. And everything's alright. Oh, man. Going on 10 years old, that song is. God bless. I love you, Mike Chase. Bye.